WGTE Public Media in Toledo. This is Storied Ground, a Northwest Ohio history podcast, where we visit our region's many historical sites and markers to rediscover the presence of the past around us in all its wonder, diversity, and complexity. I'm your host, Nick Pavlik. This is part 5 of our series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio, with guest experts Chris Houck of the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma.
Hello, my friends. My name is Two Paths, is my Wyandot name, Two Lives. I am Wyandot, and I'm of the Big Turtle Clan.
And renowned Ohio historian Mary Stockwell, author of the book The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians.
I'm a longtime resident of Ohio, and I have a PhD in American history. I was a professor for many years at Lawrence University, and I trained with some of the top guys in the American West. So the frontier in the West, to me, is synonymous with America.
In part 4 of this series, we learned how the passage of the Indian Removal Act under President Andrew Jackson in 1830, over the impassioned protests of the majority of the political representatives and citizens of Ohio, enshrined the removal of Eastern Indian nations to lands west of the Mississippi as the official Indian policy of the United States, and resulted in the forced removal of all of Ohio's indigenous nations throughout the 1830s. All but the Wyandot, who refused to leave their home of Upper Sandusky, where they had dwelt for over 100 years and become an integral part of American life in Northwest Ohio, and where they had transformed their Grand Reserve into one of the wealthiest and most educated and prosperous farming communities in the state of Ohio. We learned how Wyandot leaders used their business and legal acumen to thwart multiple attempts by American officials throughout the 1830s to convince them to remove to the West, while internally, the tribe was divided over the question of whether to leave Ohio. While the Wyandot in favor of removing to the West insisted that their people must leave before they were completely overrun by the ever-intensifying tide of white settlement in Northwest Ohio, those wishing to remain asserted that no one could force them to leave their rightful homelands, and that the tribe had the knowledge and resources by which to continue resisting the mounting pressure from the American government, as well as the support of their many friends and neighbors on nearby white farming settlements in Northwest Ohio. We learned how the proponents of remaining in Ohio among the Wyandot had continued to prevail in the tribe's internal debates on the question of removal throughout the 1830s, until the tragic and shocking murder of the Wyandot chief Samunduwat at the hands of white criminals in Henry County in 1841 finally convinced them that remaining in Ohio would be tantamount to subjecting their people to further violence under a mounting and more threatening tide of abandoned land-grabbing white settlers flooding into Northwest Ohio, and that removing to the West was in the best interest of the preservation and survival of the Wyandot Nation. And we learned how, in March of 1842, Wyandot leaders finally signed a treaty with American Indian agent John Johnston that would force their people to leave their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky for new lands in Kansas, and spent over a year painstakingly preparing for the tribe's journey west, determined to prevent the disorder and tragedies that had befallen so many other Eastern Indian nations on the many trails of tears that the Indian Removal Act had wrought. In the fifth and final part of this series, we'll learn of the Wyandot's solemn farewell to their beloved Ohio homelands and friends in 1843, of their removal west and settlement on reservations in Kansas and Oklahoma, and of their extraordinary return to their Ohio home in the present day. It's a beautiful Sunday morning in June 2024, and I'm in Upper Sandusky, Ohio, once the heart of the Wyandot Nation's Grand Reserve that had been established by the Treaty of Fort Meigs in 1817. now the seat of Wyandotte County in Northwest Ohio. Upper Sandusky has of course changed significantly since the time of the Wyandotte, but among the remnants of their historical presence here that still stands today is the Mission Church that had once been the place of worship for the many Wyandotte who had found spiritual refuge in the Methodist faith, and the adjoining cemetery where many Wyandotte ancestors lie buried, including the chiefs Between the Logs, Samundawat, and Mononkyu, who had died just before the Wyandotte departed Ohio in 1843 for Kansas. Only a half mile away, where the Wyandotte's council house once stood, lies another Wyandotte cemetery on a small plot of land on the western edge of Harrison Smith Park, where between 60 and 100 Wyandotte people are believed to be buried, though only 8 weathered gravestones have survived the centuries, including those of William Walker Sr. and his wife, Catherine Rankin Walker. As I traverse the walkways winding through the Methodist Mission Church grounds, I come upon an Ohio historical marker that had been erected along the cemetery's southern edge in 1999 by the Ohio Bicentennial Commission, the Longaberger Company, the City of Sandusky, and the Ohio Historical Society, now known as the Ohio History Connection.
Departure of the Wyandotte Indians. The 1817 Treaty of Fort Meigs opened much of Northwest Ohio to white settlement. In return, the U.S. government granted the Wyandotte Nation permanent use of the Grand Reserve at present-day Upper Sandusky. There, farming continued, a school was built, and in 1824, this mission church was constructed by Indians and Methodist missionaries. However, the Indian Removal Act of 1830 called for relocation of all Eastern Native Americans to areas beyond the Mississippi River. By 1840, all Ohio Indians had been removed except for the Wyandotte, who refused to leave, preferring instead to stay upon their beloved Sandusky, now known as Killdeer, Plains. Facing considerable pressure from federal authorities, the Wyandotte Nation in 1842 agreed to relinquish the Grand Reserve and move west. From this site on July 12, 1843, 664 individuals began their week-long journey to awaiting steamboats at Cincinnati. The Wyandotte were the last organized Native American people to leave Ohio, settling in modern-day Kansas and Oklahoma.
Only a little more than a year after my visit to Upper Sandusky, this historical marker was actually replaced with one that more appropriately recognizes Wyandotte's sovereignty and resistance in the face of the United States' attempts to forcibly remove them from their Grand Reserve and their enduring legacy and connection to their Ohio homelands today. This marker was created by Dr. Rebecca Wingo, a professor of history at the University of Cincinnati, and her students, in collaboration with the Wyandotte Nation and with the support of the William G. Pomeroy Foundation, the John Stuart Methodist Church in Upper Sandusky, and the Ohio History Connection. It is the first of 7 historical markers that will eventually be erected along the Wyandotte's removal trail in Ohio from Upper Sandusky to Cincinnati. On one side, the marker reads,
"The Wyandotte Removal Trail. The Wyandotte called the Grand Reserve home nearly a century before Ohio statehood. They built houses, cultivated the land, and grew bountiful groves of fruit trees. They governed from the nearby Wyandotte Council House and operated a productive saw and grist mill. Many sent their children to school and worshipped at the Limestone Church built in 1824 and recognized as the first Methodist mission in the country. But Ohioans set their sights on Wyandotte lands in the fertile Sandusky River Valley. State and federal governments were unwilling to allow the Wyandotte to remain on their chosen homelands, despite their participation in American society and friendly relations with neighboring settlers. Following the Indian Removal Act of 1830, the Wyandotte were the last tribe removed from the state of Ohio in 1843.
And on the other.
Upper Sandusky, July 11, 1843. The Wyandotte reached the difficult decision to remove to lands unknown along the Missouri River after decades of resistance and failed negotiations. Reverend Squire Gray Eyes delivered a farewell address at the Wyandotte Mission Church. Here our dead are buried. We have placed fresh leaves and flowers upon their graves for the last time. No longer shall we visit them. Soon they shall be forgotten, for the onward march of the strong white man will not turn aside for Indian graves. The Wyandotte began the removal trail in Upper Sandusky on July 11, 1843. After 150 arduous miles, they boarded steamboats in Cincinnati and said goodbye to their homes. However, removal from Ohio could not erase their history and legacy. Every year, citizens of the Wyandotte Nation return to celebrate their heritage.
This new historical marker is indeed much more appropriate to the occasion for which I was visiting the Wyandotte's Old Mission Church grounds in June of 2024. For this was no ordinary day in Upper Sandusky. On this day, the Wyandotte Nation had returned to the historic heart of their Ohio Grand Reserve, and many residents of the Upper Sandusky community and friends across Ohio had come to the old church grounds to welcome them home. Under a large tent outside the Mission Church building, a heavily attended welcome ceremony featuring speeches from local officials and tribal leaders was held, along with a religious service, followed by a celebratory social gathering. For many of the visiting Wyandotte, it was the first time they had ever been in Ohio, and possibly the first time a member of their family had stood on the ground of their ancestral homelands in many generations. As I observed this joyous reunion, I was struck by its historical echoes with what was likely the last time that so many Wyandotte had gathered on this ground with their Ohio friends and neighbors, over 180 years earlier, in July of 1843, for a much more sorrowful occasion. For on this day, white residents from neighboring settlements in Northwest Ohio had crowded into the old Mission Church to bid a tearful goodbye to their beloved Wyandotte friends, who, under mounting pressure, had finally agreed to sign a treaty with the United States government, forcibly removing their people from Ohio to Kansas. Here, the great chief, Squire Gray Eyes, delivered an affectionate farewell address to the Wyandotte's friends and neighbors in Northwest Ohio.
My people, the time for our departure is at hand. A few words remain only to be said. Our entire nation has gathered here for farewell. We have this morning met together for the last time in our love feast. More than 200 have testified to the great power of God. Brother Wheeler has preached the funeral for our dead, our John Stewart, our beloved Mononocue, our recently murdered Samindawat, and our eloquent Between the Logs. They sleep the sleep of death, but the hope of immortality is strong within our breast. Our chiefs have committed to the care our white brothers, our temple, to the Great Spirit, the grave of our ancestors. The Indian does not forget the pale-faced brother who came to him with the message from the Great Spirit and who loved him well and served him well. The white man's God has become the Indian's God, and with us go ever to our new home, our beloved shepherd, Brother Wheeler, and Sister Lucy Armstrong, the Wyandotte bride. Surely like the white-faced truth of all that she says, whither thou goest, I will go, and whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. And where thou diest, I will die, and there will I be buried. It remains only for me to say farewell. Yes, it is indeed farewell. No more shall we engage in the solemn feast or the feast of rejoicing. No more shall Sandusky's plains and forest echo to the voice of song and praise. No more shall we assemble in our temple to sing the sacred songs and hear the story of the cross. Here our dead are buried. We have placed fresh leaves and flowers upon their graves for the last time. No longer shall we visit them. Soon they shall be forgotten, for the onward march of the strong white man will not turn aside for Indian graves. Farewell, farewell, Sandusky River. Farewell, farewell, our hunting grounds and homes. Farewell to the stately trees and forests. Farewell to the wild creatures of the woods. Farewell to the temple of the Great Spirit. And farewell to our white brothers and friends and neighbors. It is but a little time for us till we leave our earthly home for a better country, that of a heavenly, for here we are no continuing city, but we seek the one that is to come, whose builder and maker is God. Let us remember the dying words of Brother Stewart. be faithful.
On July 11th, 1843, after over a year of meticulous preparations for their journey west, nearly 700 Wyandot bid goodbye to the Grand Reserve, their home for well over a century, and departed Upper Sandusky for Cincinnati, where they would be boarding steamboats that would take them west along the Ohio River.
And then they load themselves on wagons, and they go down what's now Ohio 68. I think of them every time I'm on it.
As the Wyandot passed through the many towns situated along the southerly trail to Cincinnati, crowds of curious onlookers came flooding out to witness the departure of the last of Ohio's native nations for lands in the then far west. The appearance of the Wyandot almost invariably drew a stark contrast to the town residents' preconceived expectations of what the departing tribe would look like, which had been shaped by exaggerated, romanticized, or stereotypical misrepresentations of Native Americans that had long circulated in print media and local legend.
But my favorite part of it was, as these people are coming down what's now US 68, all the people are coming out from little towns. Most of them don't even know who the Wyandot were that they're up there. And they all come out and it's like, oh, we're going to see these guys in feathers and buckskin. Isn't this going to be great? And I bet they'll pray to the Great Spirit every night. And here come people who look like just incredibly wealthy farmers. And they've been intermarried with whites, so they just look like, who are these wealthy people leaving Ohio? Even when they pass, the reporters still go back and write all these kind of like James Fenimore Cooper things about them.
The Torchlight, Xenia, Ohio, July 20th, 1843. The Wyandots. The remains of this once flourishing tribe of Indians passed through our town on Sunday morning last. The general appearance of these Indians was truly prepossessing. Every one of them, we believe, without an exception, was decently dressed, a large proportion of them in the costume of the whites. Their deportment was quite orderly and respectful. We are informed that nearly one half of them make a profession of the Christian religion. They appeared to be well fitted out for their journey, having a convenient variety of cooking utensils and provisions in abundance. The whole number of persons in the company, so far as we could learn, was about 750. The number of wagons, carriages, and buggies owned by the tribe, about 80. Hired wagons, 55. Horses and ponies, near 300. Our citizens seemed to look upon the scene of their departure from among us with feelings of melancholy interest. To reflect that the last remnant of a powerful people, once the proud possessors of the soil we now occupy, were just leaving their beloved hunting grounds and the graves of their ancestors, that their council fires had gone out and their wigwams were deserted, was well calculated to awaken the liveliest sympathies of the human heart. No one, we are sure, who felt such emotions could refrain from breathing a devout aspiration to the Great Spirit that he would guide and protect them on their journey and carefully preserve them as a people after they shall have arrived at their new home in the far, far west.
When the Wyandot reached the town of Urbana, the tribe's head chief, Henry Jacques, diverted 50 miles east to the state capital of Columbus, where he met with Governor Wilson Shannon to deliver an official farewell message to all Ohioans on behalf of the Wyandot Nation.
We part with the people of Ohio with feelings the more kind because there has not been any hostility between your people and ours ever since the Treaty of General Wayne at Greenville. Almost 50 years of profound peace between us have passed away and have endeared your people to ours. Whatever may be our future fate beyond the Mississippi, whether we are bound, we shall always entertain none but feelings the most kind and grateful toward the people of Ohio. Before Wayne's treaty, there had been one long war between our fathers and your ancestors. At that treaty, our people promised peace, and they have kept that promise faithfully. We will forever keep that promise as long as the sun shines and the rivers run. When we arrive at the place of our destination, surrounded as we shall be by red men less acquainted with them than we are with white men, we shall always take great pleasure in telling the Indians of that western region how kind, how peaceful, how true, faithful, and honest your people have been to our people. If at any future day any of our people shall visit this state, we hope that your people will see that they do not suffer for food or any of the necessities of life, that when thirsty you will give him drink, when hungry you shall give him food, or naked you will give him clothes, or sick you will heal him. And we on our part promise the same kindness to any of your people should they visit us in our far western future home. Our fathers have ranged this valley with your fathers in peace and friendship, and we wish your people to know that we have the same kind of feelings that existed in times past, and we wish you to know that we wish to perpetuate and keep alive the same brotherly feelings. In other states and territories, the Indians have lived surrounded by white men with whom they had occasional outbreaks, wars, and difficulties. But between us and your people, the chain of peace and friendship has always continued to be bright, smooth, and free from rusty or bloody spots. You are the representative of your people, therefore be so good as to tell your people that we say on this final parting occasion, and say to them to believe us to be always hereafter what we have always been, the friends of the people of Ohio.
On July 20th, 1843, after a two-day stay in Cincinnati, the Wyandot finally boarded the steamboats the Republic and the Nottoway and headed down the Ohio River toward Kansas.
And they come down to Cincinnati. They buy the tickets on the steamboat, get on the steamboats.
We were on two riverboats, the Nottoway and the Republic, and they boarded in Cincinnati.
As they reached the village of North Bend, near the Ohio border with Indiana, the Wyandot passed by the tomb of William Henry Harrison, the former United States President and Army General, under whom many Wyandot warriors had served in the War of 1812. Though as president, Harrison had betrayed the Wyandot's hopes of forever remaining on their Ohio homelands, instead appointing the Indian agent John Johnston to negotiate their final removal treaty. The tribe still revered Harrison, referring to him as their white chief. As they passed Harrison's tomb, sitting high on a bluff overlooking the Ohio River, the Wyandot asked the steamboat captains to fire off the ship's cannons in tribute to their departed friend. Wyandot men who had served with Harrison stood on the decks of their ships, removing their hats and waving them toward Harrison's grave as head chief Henry Jacques stepped forward. "Farewell, Ohio and her brave," he shouted. As the steamboats carried them down the Ohio River toward Kansas, the Wyandot had to contend not only with the trauma of having left their beloved Ohio homelands behind, and the uncertainty of still not knowing exactly where in Kansas they would be able to settle once they arrived, but also with the prejudice of the captain of the steamboat, the Nottoway, on whom they were relying to safely transport them to their new home.
Everything was fine till they got to Louisville. And at that time, the captain of the Nottoway had all the carpets ripped up, rolled up, furniture put into storage on the boat because he didn't want Indians soiling his carpets. So they made the trip like that and were treated very poorly. When we paid them at Louisville, as soon as they had the first payment, they were done with us. And then St. Louis to Westport on the Missouri side. The night they arrived, it was really rainy and drizzly, just a miserable, nasty night. And they said, "Well, can we just stay on the boat for tonight and we'll get off?" "Oh, no, I got to be in St. Joseph by morning." Next morning, when they all got up, guess where that riverboat was? Right there. And he had all the carpets and everything put back down, because his other passengers, you know, they had to have it nice. He didn't want the Indians trashing it because they're Indians. Now, granted, most of them would have been wearing clothes like everyone else of the day. And anyway, when they arrived, they were dropped on the wrong side of the river. There's a strip of Kansas that's on the east side, and it's a mud flat. And that's where we were dropped. So we had to figure out how to get across the river to Kansas, where we belonged.
In late July 1843, after replenishing their supplies and loading up wagons at the store in Westport, Missouri, that a Wyandot advance party had set up for the tribe's arrival, the Wyandot found a way across the Kansas River into their new home of Kansas and headed for the location at the juncture of the Missouri and Kansas rivers that their advance party had selected for them. Despite the hardships experienced on the journey west, The Wyandots' meticulously laid preparations for their journey had protected their people from the calamities that had been experienced by other Native nations of Ohio, such as the Seneca and the Shawnee, during their removals in the 1830s.
They go out to Westport, Missouri. They get wagons. I think only one old woman died. One child died of a fever out in Missouri, if I remember it correctly. They kept their people alive and their horses alive. So it's a stunning story.
With the Shawnee having been pressured by the United States government to rescind their initial offer to sell land to the Wyandot in Kansas, for nearly 6 months, the Wyandot resided in what they considered to be temporary homes on 39 sections of land owned by their friends the Delaware, until they finally purchased these sections from the Delaware in December of 1843.
The Delaware said, "Here's land. We'll sell it to you." Now, granted, they sold it for $2 an acre instead of a dollar like the going rate. First land speculators were our friends. But that's how we got land in Kansas. We'd been promised land, and we get there, and there's nothing. We get dumped on the wrong side of the river on a mud flat. So the Delaware were our friends.
Despite their inauspicious arrival in Kansas, after they officially purchased their new reserve from the Delaware, the Wyandot began the arduous work of rebuilding the prosperous farming community they had known on their Grand Reserve in Ohio. They built log cabins on new farms where they grew corn, beans, and potatoes, laid out roads, built churches and schools, and founded a temperance society. The capital they established on their new reserve, Wyandot City, would eventually go on to become part of Kansas City, Kansas.
And they go out and overnight, Kansas City, Kansas is born because the Wyandot are there.
Though they quickly established a burgeoning agricultural settlement on their new Kansas reserve, many of the Wyandot who had made the journey from Ohio to Kansas would not live to see it. Within the first year of the Wyandot's arrival in Kansas, more than 60 of their people had died, reducing their numbers to only 565 individuals. It is not an overstatement to wonder how many of those Wyandot people who had perished within the first year of arriving in Kansas had died of broken hearts. As they endured on their new lands into the 1850s, the Wyandot and the many other Eastern indigenous nations who had been forced west to Kansas and Oklahoma would be met by yet more drastic change and consequential upheaval of the kind that the Wyandot leader William Walker Jr., when on a scouting party to Kansas in the early 1830s, had once warned his people about.
Once they get to Kansas, Walker's prediction is true, that the war begins and trouble begins.
Though he had been elected as the first provisional governor of the Nebraska Territory in July of 1853.
William Walker Jr. was the first territorial governor of Nebraska Territory, which was Kansas and Nebraska. First one. He's a native.
Walker's election as provisional governor was not accepted by the United States government, which in May of 1854 passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act that officially created the U.S. territories of Kansas and Nebraska, under the governorship of Democrats Andrew Horatio Reeder and Francis Burt, respectively. The act formally opened Kansas and Nebraska to white settlement and also repealed the Missouri Compromise that had prohibited the expansion of slavery there, instead allowing for the citizens of each territory to decide the slavery question for themselves by a vote of popular sovereignty. As William Walker Jr. had feared, this thrust the Wyandot's new home of Kansas into the country's intensifying fight over the expansion of slavery, and the Kansas Territory erupted in a series of violent conflicts between pro- and anti-slavery forces, now known as Bleeding Kansas. Meanwhile, new waves of American land speculators, gold prospectors, pioneer settlers, and railroad companies flooded through the Indians' Kansas Territory, driving America's unrelenting expansion to the west coast of the North American continent. Within just a decade of the Wyandot's removal from Ohio to Kansas, the United States betrayed the promises it had made to the Wyandot in their 1842 removal treaty.
Treaties were not honored. The Treaty of 1842, whenever we agreed to leave, the government didn't come through for them.
Once again, the American government came to the Wyandot and other indigenous nations who had settled onto promised reserves in Kansas to enact new treaties in which the United States took possession of vast amounts of land that had been promised as belonging to the Indians. For the Wyandot, the question of American citizenship also now emerged as a cultural fault line that caused divisions within the nation. In 1855, George Manypenny, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs under the U.S. President Franklin Pierce, offered a treaty to the Wyandot that would provide American citizenship and individual plats of land to tribal members in exchange for much of the remaining land comprising their Kansas Reserve. Under the influence of tribal leaders such as William Walker Jr., who believed American citizenship to be in the best interest of the tribe, many of the Wyandot agreed, and the Manypenny Treaty, as it was called, was signed, officially ending the existence of the Wyandot as an historically sovereign American Indian nation.
William Walker Jr. was very close with Lewis Cass, governor of Michigan, and then eventually he became the Secretary of War. He and William Walker Jr., they were thick as thieves. They were best buddies. Jr. was at one point his personal secretary, and he told William Walker Jr., Kansas is going to be a native state. It'll be run by natives, but you got to become citizens. They started that whole citizenship thing, but William Walker Jr. bought into it. He convinced a lot of these people to take U.S. citizenship.
And most of the Wyandot became citizens of Kansas, and they got their property to them through that, and then quickly they were citizens of the U.S.
But there remained a contingent of the Wyandot who were fervently against the 1855 treaty and refused to accept American citizenship, wishing to preserve the Wyandot's cultural and political sovereignty as an indigenous nation. Among the opponents of the treaty were those Wyandot who, during the tribe's time on the Grand Reserve in Ohio, had generally upheld the Wyandot's traditional life ways and resisted assimilation into broader American society, as well as their descendants. These individuals eventually left Kansas for Oklahoma, designated at the time as Indian Territory, where they sought to retain their tribal identity and uphold their traditional life ways.
Well, if they don't want to be citizens, then they can go to Indian Territory. This started about 1855. This went on, minus the war years, until 1867. It was like, if you want to stay tribal, you will go to Indian Territory. So some stayed. It's like, we just got our lives back. Why would I want to go? So I don't blame anybody's ancestors stayed in Kansas. I get it. But the people they sent down here were people that were of no use to them. People that didn't have skills. People that were old. We'll say widows and orphans. People that weren't contributing members of society, they wanted to get rid of. The incompetent class might have been someone that's too old, or they may simply not speak English. Something that simple. But those were the ones that ended up down here.
But the citizenship question wasn't the only issue that had created a division within Wyandot society and influenced some Wyandot people's decision to leave Kansas for Indian Territory. A less prevalent, but still salient issue for the Wyandot that had created further splintering within the tribe was slavery. As the upheavals of Bleeding Kansas swept through the lands on which the Eastern Indian nations had settled in the Kansas Territory, some prominent Wyandot leaders, while publicly denouncing slavery, privately became slaveholders themselves.
Now, there were some Wyandots that were slaveholders. William Walker Jr. was one of them.
Members of the tribe who said, this is horrible. We will not be a part of the slave sale. They moved to Oklahoma.
The vast majority of the Wyandot of Kansas, however, remained deeply against slavery. In fact, the Wyandot town of Quindaro, founded outside Kansas City along the Missouri River in 1857, for a time became a vital stop on the Underground Railroad and is known to have helped many enslaved people from Missouri escape to freedom.
There was a small area, it's now a part of Kansas City, Kansas, Quindaro. It was just not much left there, but Quindaro actually was one of the largest stops on the Underground Railroad.
For 12 years after the signing of the Manypenny Treaty in 1855, the Wyandot Nation had technically ceased to exist. But in 1867, owing to persistent advocacy efforts from leaders on a Wyandot governing body called the Indian Party Council, the United States government offered a new treaty that formally designated the Wyandot living in Indian Territory in Oklahoma as the Wyandot Tribe, reinstating their official status as an American Indian nation and granting the tribe a reservation of 20,000 acres. Those Wyandot who had accepted American citizenship in Kansas in the Menipeni Treaty were excluded from this new treaty. However, if they wished to reclaim their status as citizens of the Wyandot tribe, the treaty contained an inclusionary clause by which they could petition the Indian Party leaders to be adopted back into the tribe. Beginning in the early 1870s, many Wyandot of Kansas, including Chris Houck's ancestors, were officially adopted back into the Wyandot tribe and relocated to the Wyandot's reservation in Indian Territory.
But there were also some, like one of my grandparents, they said, well, we'll take citizenship, but we want the right to be tribal, which that didn't come about until about 1874. Finally, people were like, okay, this is not going the way we wanted. They would petition the Indian Party and say, hey, we want to come to Oklahoma. And especially my family, who were very well-to-do, they were land floats. They laid out Wyandot City. Isaiah Walker, my grandfather, and some of them, they started laying out Topeka. So they were out speculating on that. Well, about 1874, when William Walker Jr. died, his nephew, Isaiah, they came down here. And of course they were wanted because they were well-to-do. Their home is still here. It's a nice frame house for the time. I've been and visited the family that owns it now, who actually bought it from the Walkers, their descendants. One was a little boy whenever his grandfather bought the place from the Walkers during the Depression, because times were hard. But they still let Uncle Ike, they even called him. He lived in a little building out back of the house and had him a couple of cows and that he milked every day and walked to Seneca several miles, and he'd go sell the milk and come back with a bottle that was about half empty by the time he got home. There's conflicting stories if he was very pleasant. The older gentleman that knew him said, oh, I loved him. And then one of the other siblings that said, if only he would leave, I would come home. So take it for what you will.
Through the Treaty of 1867, the Wyandot had ensured their continuation as a culturally distinct and recognized Indian nation. But just 20 years later, they would suffer yet another consequential blow, as land rushes fueled by America's unrelenting westward expansion again threatened to overrun native peoples in Indian Territory. In 1887, the United States Congress passed the Dawes Severalty Act, which used the Land Ordinance of 1785 to subdivide land on Indian reservations into allotments granted to the heads of families and individuals listed on tribal rolls. While it was ostensibly intended to protect Native American property rights, the act also seized vast amounts of land promised for Indian reservations and opened it for American settlement, and further pressured Native nations to abandon their traditional lifeways and assimilate into the dominant American culture.
The Wyandot, when they were sent here, we were given allotments. We were not given a reservation per se. Yes, it was a Wyandot reserve, but they wanted us to each have their own farm, 140 or 80 acres, and they wanted us to worry more about keeping our family fed than about causing the U.S. government trouble, because the Wyandots are diplomats. They always have been.
But throughout the 20th century, the Indian policy of the United States government would undergo profound changes, as the U.S. at last sought to provide fair restitution to the indigenous nations who had been dispossessed of their homelands and suffered so greatly under decades of assimilationist policies and the colossal force of American nation-building in the 19th century. While President Ulysses S. Grant had failed in his attempts to enact universal citizenship for Native peoples under his Indian policy, referred to as the Peace Policy, in the 1870s, in 1924, Congress successfully passed the Indian Citizenship Act, in which all Native peoples born in the United States were granted full U.S. citizenship, while also retaining their status as citizens of their respective tribal nations.
Jackson floated it. If you stay, well, you'll be American citizens, but it's not going to be official. But U.S. Grant will be the first president who says the goal is that these people have been here. They're with us. They're Americans. Give them citizenship. He didn't succeed, but it eventually will come between his time in the 1920s.
In 1934, the Indian Reorganization Act ended the land allotment policy instituted under the Dawes Act of 1887, restored communal lands back to the tribes, and reaffirmed tribal sovereignty by granting Indian nations the right to establish their own constitutions and form legally recognized tribal governments. Under the Reorganization Act, in 1937, the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma officially reorganized its tribal government through the establishment of a constitution and bylaws. And in 1946, the Indian Claims Act established the Indian Claims Commission as a special tribunal to hear and resolve Native nations' grievances against the United States government, stemming from a long history of devalued land sales, broken treaties, and tribal dispossession. In the 1960s, the Wyandotte Nation of Kansas successfully brought a suit against the United States through the Indian Claims Commission.
The Wyandotte of Kansas came back in the 1960s under the Indian Claims Commission that Harry Truman set up. If you don't think you got a deal, your people in a treaty, you go to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government pays you. So the Wyandotte of Kansas brought the suit, and there was a lawyer in Toledo who studied, had they been paid properly? They won, and they took the money, and they bought the 7th Street Casino in Kansas City. So I used to tell my students, if you're out there and you want to help the Wyandotte, I am like the non-gambler of all time. I won't even buy a lottery ticket, but I will make an exception in this case.
The Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma had also successfully appealed to the Indian Claims Commission in the 1950s. Though it was not until the 1980s that the tribe finally received a settlement fund from the U.S. government worth several million dollars.
Almost all the tribes have been paid and paid and paid in full now for what they are owed. That's, to me, a fascinating little bit of history. At least they've been paid properly now for what they lost.
Today, the descendants of the Wyandotte live throughout the United States, but they are principally based in three locations that reflect the tribe's long history of displacement and forced removal from Canada to Michigan, Ohio, Kansas, and ultimately Oklahoma. The Wyandotte of Anderdon Nation, located south of Detroit, Michigan, is comprised of the descendants of the Wyandotte who lived among the French near Detroit in the early 1700s and remained there when many other Wyandotte people decided to migrate to the area centered around Upper Sandusky in Ohio, from which they were forcibly removed to Kansas in 1843. The Wyandotte Nation of Kansas, located just west of Kansas City, is comprised of the descendants of the Wyandotte who remained in Kansas after the Menipenny Treaty of 1855 that conferred American citizenship upon the Wyandotte people and, for a time, effectively ended the legal existence of the Wyandotte as a tribal nation. And the federally recognized Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, located in Ottawa County in northeastern Oklahoma, is home to the descendants of the Wyandotte who refused American citizenship under the 1855 Menipenny Treaty and moved to Indian Territory, where they were officially reinstated as the Wyandotte Tribe in 1867, as well as the Kansas Wyandotte, who later petitioned to rejoin the Wyandotte Tribe on their Oklahoma reservation. And though they have resided on their Oklahoma reservation since 1867, it was not until 2024 that a ruling by the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals conclusively reaffirmed their lands as an officially designated Indian reservation under the sovereign jurisdiction of the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma.
We recently got reservation status here in the Wyandotte Nation, so that's kind of an exciting thing. Law enforcement and our judicial area, their responsibility have boomed, they've exploded. Because it's a lot of responsibility whenever you have we're not a huge reservation, but it is what it is. So there's a lot more authority comes to our law enforcement and our judicial system.
While the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma may be the only federally recognized Wyandotte tribe due to a long and complex legal history characterized by broken treaties and assimilationist policies, this does not diminish the shared ancestry, history, and culture that bind the Wyandotte nations of Michigan, Kansas, and Oklahoma together as one people who have endured through centuries of cataclysmic change and upheaval brought about by colonialist dispossession.
They've made their own way. Wyandottes are a lot like willow trimmings. If you ever cut a limb off of a willow tree and stick it in the ground, it'll grow. It'll turn into a tree. That's the way the Wyandotte are. Wherever you stick us, we're going to grow, no matter what we have to do it.
Yet, there is one place of deep significance in Wyandotte history where the tribe does not have any kind of formal presence today. Ohio. But at the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma's Cultural Center and Museum, Chris Houck and his team are leading the charge to help the Wyandotte reconnect to their ancestral home in the Ohio country.
We've been in Oklahoma longer than we were in Ohio, but Ohio was the last place we wanted to be. We chose to be there, not somewhere else. So a lot of people are starting to feel that connection back to Ohio. Pretty much every year we'll take our interns there. They need to see where we're from. They need to understand that it's home. It is nice to go up and let people see, just to feel the presence of the ancestors. I can go to some of my great-grandparents, visit their graves, and know that they were here. They were real people.
The graves of Chris Houck's Ohio ancestors are located at two historic sites that are among several that bear witness to the Wyandotte's historical presence in Ohio. The Wyandotte Cemetery on the western edge of Harrison Smith Park, and the grounds of the Old Methodist Mission Church, both in Upper Sandusky. These sites preserve the final resting places of the ancestors of many members of the Wyandotte Nations of Kansas and Oklahoma, and were promised as belonging to the Wyandotte forever in the 1842 treaty that forcibly removed them from their Ohio homelands.
The cemetery is still there, and even when the tribe leaves and goes out west, they are guaranteed that cemetery near the church and that church will belong to the Wyandotte forever.
When the Wyandotte were removed from their Grand Reserve in 1843, they had left the Mission Church and its adjoining cemetery in trust to the Missionary Society of the Methodist Episcopal Church. But over the next half century, the church was sadly neglected and slowly crumbled into disrepair. However, in 1889, the Methodist Church rebuilt the Mission Church using the same limestone from the Sandusky River that the Wyandotte had used to build the original church in 1824 and restored it as an historic place of worship. Later, in 1960, the General Conference of the Methodist Church designated the Mission Church a National Historic Shrine, commemorating both Methodist and Wyandotte history in Ohio. And in 2019, the Methodist Missionary Society officially returned the Mission Church to the ownership of the Wyandotte Nation. Today, volunteers from the John Stewart Methodist Church in Upper Sandusky preserve and care for the Mission Church building on behalf of the Wyandotte Nation, providing church services and historic tours there during the summer months.
When we left it in the possession of the Methodist Church and said, take care of this. Later on, in later years, it was all falling in, and they went back and redid it. The Methodists did. It was an actual church up there for many, many years. And then in 2019, they actually returned it to us. We actually own the church and the cemetery and all of that that's important to us.
If you haven't seen the replica of the little church that was built, go to Upper Sandusky. Usually in the summertime, they bring in preachers from all over to preach there.
We have some great people. They're from Upper Sandusky that take care of it for us. They're phenomenal people, and we know we can trust them to take care of what's ours, and they preserve that memory. But walking into that church, that small building, it's pretty powerful. You feel it.
Dr. Mary Stockwell certainly experienced the Mission Church's powerful connection to Wyandotte history when she visited the site while conducting research for her book, The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians.
I remember when I was doing my research there, I read so much and I'm driving to Upper Sandusky. I know every hill. I know where I am. And it's like, no GPS. And my poor two sisters and our dogs were with us. And it's like, look over there. There's a little gauntlet. And we find it just because I've read so much about it. But I come running in. I want to do this in historic sites. I was so excited, and it was a nice lady running it. I just run through it, looking at all the paintings. My God, Mononcu, between the logs, Tari the crane. Yeah. I think I frightened her, but I, it was.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm doing fine, and you?
That nice lady, Dr. Stockwell worries she may have frightened with her enthusiasm, may very well have been Nancy Sauer, one of the volunteers from the John Stewart Methodist Church in Upper Sandusky, who helps care for the old Mission Church, and whom I met when I visited the site on the occasion of the Wyandotte's return to Upper Sandusky in June of 2024.
Would you like a tour or just a look around?
Yes, a tour would be great.
I can tell you a little.
It turned out she could tell me quite a lot, as she provided me with a wonderful tour of the Mission Church, honoring the historic connection between the Methodist Church and the Wyandotte Nation, starting with a painting on the church's west wall, capturing the likeness of the missionary who first brought the Methodist faith to the Grand Reserve and helped change the course of Wyandotte history.
First of all, John Stewart was born in Virginia. His parents were Baptist, and his parents picked up and moved from Virginia to Tennessee. Well, when he saved up enough money, he headed to join his parents in Tennessee. He got as far as Marietta, and he was robbed. And he had no friends and no money, so he went into Marietta, and he fell into the wrong crowd and became a drunkard. And one day, he was walking down the street, and he came across a Methodist revival, and he went in. And he went in, and he refound his faith and his religion. And one day when he was having devotions, he felt he heard God calling him. And God told him that he must preach to people. And of course, he refused. No, I don't have the words. I'm just dumb. I can't do this. And so he went on and he got extremely sick. And he told God that if he got well, he would do what he told him to. And of course, he did get better. So John Stewart then walked 200 miles to the wilderness to come here to the Wyandottes. And in 1816, that's when he started his mission of converting the Wyandottes. So the first time John Stewart held a sermon, one old woman came. And then the second time she brought her husband. So there were two. And he had a melodious voice, and they loved to hear him sing, and maybe that's why people started coming. But it took him quite a long time to convince that he was actually very sincere, and he did follow what he was preaching.
Next was a portrait of the Reverend James B. Finley, who administered to the Wyandotte during a time of transformative cultural and spiritual renewal for the tribe that had helped bring them out of a time of desolation following the War of 1812 and the 1817 Treaty of Fort Meigs that had forced them onto their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky.
John Stewart never saw this church because he was only here for 7 years and he died of tuberculosis, they suspect. Anyway, Reverend James Finley had come to help him minister to the Wyandottes. And so he's the one that's responsible for the building of this mission. This mission was built with government funds. It's the only mission that ever was built with government funds. And it was built in 1824. Also, it is the very first Methodist mission in the United States. And also there was a school, and no one knows for sure just exactly where the school was. But there was a school that the Wyandottes went to, and the children would stay there and they'd learn how to raise cattle and how to farm, and the girls how to knit and sew and all those kind of things that they need to do.
Following was a series of photographs pertaining to the period in the late 19th century when the Methodist Church rebuilt the original Mission Church that had fallen into ruin.
Well, during that time, they had left the deed for the church to the white Methodists in town. And a few of the churches held services out here in this church until their churches in town had been built. And then the church was neglected. They just let it. And it fell down. This man, Reverend N.B.C. Love, was a minister of the Methodist Church, and he became interested in the mission, seeing that it's all falling down and everything. And he found the deed, which had been lost, and in 1889, he was instrumental in having the mission rebuilt, and they did use the stones that were here. It's made of gray limestone, and they say it came from the Sandusky River. As you can see, the picture on the left there is how the mission kind of looked before he reconstructed it. There's like one wall still standing, the roof caved in. Yeah, it was a real mess. And sometimes people came and took part of it because they were souvenir hunters. The church in 1889, when it was finished, was rededicated. And this is a picture of the rededication in 1889. It is also on the Registry of Historic Places. It was placed there in 1960.
At this point, as new visitors arrived through the church's front doors, Miss Sauer turned toward the doors and remarked upon the historical reason for their placement at opposite sides of the church's front entrance.
You will notice that there are two doors.
Yes.
That's because the men came in one and the women and children came in the other one. They felt that they could get more out of the service if they weren't sitting with their families. So they would sit on opposite sides of the church, and then when the service was over, they would leave by the door they came in.
This provided occasion to remark upon other architectural and structural features of the church.
I read just recently that the platform is the only thing that is really original in the inside of the church. And I know for a fact the floor isn't, because we've replaced it.
Right.
We have problems with bugs.
Having shared some of the artifacts relating specifically to the history of the Methodist Mission Church itself and its ministers, Ms. Sauer then turned to those items representing the history of the Wyandotte people for whom the church had been built, starting with a drawing depicting Jonathan Poynter, a formerly enslaved man who had been captured and later taken in by the Wyandotte and had served as John Stewart's interpreter.
And this is the drawing of Jonathan Poynter, translating for John Stewart. Poynter was also a black man, and he had been kidnapped as a child so he could speak both English and Wyandotte. And so he was the interpreter for John Stewart.
Next came portraits of three of the Wyandotte's most eminent chiefs during the tribe's time on the Grand Reserve, who had helped forge a new path to renewal for their people as the Wyandotte transformed their reserve into one of Ohio's most prosperous farming communities from the 1820s to the 1840s.
Some of the converts that are pictured here also are Reverend Between the Logs, Mononcue. Between the Logs and Mononcue both became ministers. This is Chief Squire Gray Eyes. He was one of the influential chiefs at the time when they left.
And then there was an old photograph, appearing to be from the late 19th century, of an elderly Wyandotte woman I had never seen before.
That is Mother Solomon. Actually, she was Margaret Gray Eyes. She's the daughter of Squire Gray Eyes. And she was the last Wyandotte to live in this area from the original tribe. That's a real photograph of Mother Solomon. They called her Mother Solomon because she actually had like about 10 kids and they all died. So she had no children of her own. And so she was like the community babysitter, and she helped women when they were having babies and things. And so that she became known as Mother Solomon. She did go to Kansas with the tribe in 1843, but in 1850, she and her husband decided to come back. And they moved back to this area and had a little cabin here. So she was the last of the original tribe to live here.
If Margaret Gray Eyes Solomon was the last of the historical Ohio Wyandotte to live in Upper Sandusky, it was under the leadership of the chief depicted in the next photograph, Leiford Bearskin, that the descendants of the Ohio Wyandotte began regularly returning to their people's ancestral homelands in Upper Sandusky. In 2007, the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma established an internship program that annually brings Wyandotte youth back to their historic Ohio home. Chief Bearskin served as chief of the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma from 1983 until shortly before his death in 2012.
And he was a great man, and he actually was in the military. Then he came back and they made him chief of the Wyandottes, and he has done great things for the Wyandottes. He has passed. He is no longer living. I actually did meet him. He came to Upper Sandusky, but it was a long time ago, many years ago.
The next portrait was of Chief Billy Friend, the current chief of the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, who had succeeded Chief Bearskin in 2011.
This painting is of Chief Friend, and I have to tell you a neat story about him. When he was elected the chief, we said, "Well, Chief, now that you've been elected chief, what do we call you?" He looked at me and said, "Billy." Such a nice guy. Very, very ordinary, but so powerful.
Ms. Sauer had in fact seen Chief Friend just the previous evening at a welcome dinner the John Stewart Methodist Church had hosted for the Wyandotte Nation upon their return to their Upper Sandusky home.
It was very nice dinner. They had a young man who offered the prayer in Wyandotte, and then he translated, and it was kind of acute thing.
Yeah.
Because it ended with, now let's eat.
Ms. Sauer then proudly unfurled the Mission Church's replica of the flag of the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma, a symbolic representation of the tribe's history and sovereignty as an American Indian nation.
This is the Wyandot flag, because they are actually a nation. It has a turtle in the middle of it, because the ancient Wyandots believed that the earth was formed on the back of a turtle. I'm not sure of all the symbols either. I know that there are 12 white points, and those 12 points, each one represents a clan, war, and peace. And they were the keepers of the flame.
The council fire.
Yes, they were known as the grandfathers. And actually, when they have their own vehicles, that's what their license plate looks like, too, because they are a nation.
By this point, we had made our way near a display case toward the back of the church, showcasing various items for sale for the benefit of the preservation of the Mission Church, including copies of books by the late Wyandot County local historian, Thelma R. Marsh. I asked Nancy Sauer about the extent to which local K-12 students have been taught about the history of the great Wyandot Nation who once resided in their community.
Did you grow up in Upper Sandusky?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Were you taught about the Wyandot when you were young?
Actually, Mrs. Marsh, who has written all those books, she was my fourth grade teacher.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yes, I was. And these days, every third grade class in Upper, and I think Carrie also does, takes a tour, and they have a unit about the Wyandot Indians and about Indians in general, and then they take a tour of the mission and the courthouse and the museum and the Indian Mill, and some of them go to McCutcheonsville, where the Overland Inn is, too.
As my tour of the Mission Church came to a close, Ms. Sauer kindly shared one last artifact with me, a framed document that, from my rudimentary understanding, I could tell was written in the Wyandot language, but I of course had little idea of the text's meaning.
This is the Lord's Prayer in Wyandot. Now, what happened was the children were taught to speak English at the school. And so actually Wyandot became a language that no one really spoke. So they have been working very hard to regain. And you heard, apparently they have regained a lot of it. And
yes,
they are teaching their children Wyandot now too.
The Wyandot's recovery of their ancient language is one of the tribe's many present-day tribal heritage programs being led by researchers and interpreters like Chris Houck and his team at the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma's Cultural Center and Museum to reclaim and revitalize the Wyandot Nation's traditional lifeways and to reconnect their people to their Iroquoian heritage and identity.
I am a lifeways researcher. That is my job, is trying to bring these things back. We are Iroquoian. We're not Anishinaabe or Algonquin or any of that. We are Iroquoian. So we're very similar to the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee back east, but we're not them. There are differences. Even our creation story, which they're close, real close, but there are differences. So we are who we are. There are those of us that are learning those old ways. It's very important to not forget them. I go to elders and I will ask, if I don't know, teach me. And I have learned so much.
The Wyandot have been able to recover much of their language today by listening to their ancestors, quite literally, in fact.
We're reawakening our language. It's not dead, it was just sleeping. There was a Canadian anthropologist, Charles Marius Barbeau, that came down in 1911 and 12 to Wyandot, Oklahoma, and he did interviews with the old ones, the people that had lived in Ohio. They'd been through those Kansas times and all that. They were in their late 70s and 80s when Barbeau talked to them, and they sang songs and they told stories, and they did a lot of language. And about two-thirds of our language has come from Barbeau's notes and his recordings. Last native speaker died in the 1950s.
The awakening of their language has been deeply intertwined with the Wyandot's recovery of the traditional songs of their people, which they are now learning to sing once again.
We sing the songs. We actually have our songs. They're no one else's. We started a singing group here about 2 years ago. I've been singing for 3 years. I went to Richard Zane Smith. He's a Kansas Wyandotte. He is the most Wyandotte person I know, and he knows all this. And I offered him tobacco, and I asked, I said, would you teach me? And he says, yes. So every Tuesday night, I go down for a couple hours, and we'd sing. He taught me that. And then I thought, you know, this can't just be me. So now we have about a dozen different people that all get together every Thursday night, and we sing for 2 hours, and we talk about important things, a lot of the language. Richard makes sure we pronounce things right. He's taught us Thanksgiving addresses and different speeches, like we introduce our social songs in our language, talk about the earth songs of our people and the Wyandotte ways and how important they are.
And on that beautiful June day in 2024, when the Wyandotte Nation returned to their Ohio homelands, Upper Sandusky rang out once again with sounds that likely hadn't been heard here for hundreds of years. At Stepping Stones Park, where legend says that Wyandotte children once crossed the Sandusky River to attend the mission school on the Grand Reserve, the Wyandotte singing group performed some of the ancient songs of their people that they had learned under tribal elder Richard Zane Smith, as other members of the tribe joined in traditional Wyandotte social dances. A few months after I was fortunate enough to witness this stunning event in Upper Sandusky, on a windy but uncharacteristically mild and sunny day in October of 2024, I made my way down to the Fort Recovery Museum and Monument in Mercer County, Ohio, the site of General Arthur St. Clair's defeat in 1791 during the Northwest Indian War, to enjoy the opportunity of learning still more about the Wyandotte's tribal history and heritage from cultural researchers and interpreters Chris Houck, Kim Garcia, and Joshua Garcia from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma's Cultural Center and Museum. It was the weekend of the Ohio History Connection's second annual program at Fort Recovery, called Beyond the Battlefield and St. Clair's Defeat, Connecting with Tribal Nations Today, where representatives from several indigenous nations who once called Ohio home, including the Delaware, Miami, Odawa, Seneca, Shawnee, and Wyandotte, came to share their tribal history and heritage in the form of demonstrations, performances, and historical artifacts with an enthusiastic public. At the Wyandotte Nation's well-attended afternoon tent demonstration, Chris, Kim, and Joshua discussed the historical context behind the tribe's present-day revitalization of their traditional music and dances.
Good morning, everybody. Hello, my friends. My English name, as you heard, I'm Chris Houck. My Wyandotte name is Tehanye Dupte, which means two paths, and I am of the Big Turtle Clan. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about how we started bringing our music back. This was something that, unfortunately, a lot of tribes have lost. Some have managed to maintain.
Chris then relayed the story of how Canadian anthropologist Charles Marius Barbeau had come to Oklahoma in the early 20th century to record Wyandotte stories and songs from tribal elders, and how, thanks to the preservation efforts of archivists at the University of Indiana, Barbeau's fragile wax cylinder recordings have survived into the present day and made it possible for the Wyandotte to rediscover their traditional language and songs.
Barbeau went and he brought down a way to record them on wax cylinders. They're about 2 minutes in the length. He sat down and he would pay these elders $1 a day to come. And all they had to do was come to the Seneca Indian School, sit down, speak, sing, tell stories into this big horn, and recorded them. As you know, the recording technology then was not great. But even now, the originals, they pop and they crack and they're hard to hear. But again, we had some very fortunate things happen. A couple of years ago, we came up to the University of Indiana and we found they had a digital collection of these songs, of the Barbeau recordings. Then also there's field notes that Barbeau had. He says, these are the oldest Wyandotte songs I know. These things could be hundreds, if not thousands of years old, we don't know. So we started going through the Barbeau collection. We have a gentleman who's Wyandotte Nation of Kansas that lives locally, Richard Zane Smith, who's also a master potter. And he started going and taking these, getting the words, getting the music. And several years ago, I asked him, would you teach me? And then after going to his house and doing this for a while, it's like, this is too good, we gotta share this. So now there's about a dozen of us that all get together every Thursday night and we sing these old songs. Our music group is Sapo Tredute, and it means they sing again. So these old songs, they mean a lot to us.
As you can hear, the Wyandotte's traditional songs also feature the rhythmic and percussive sound of ancient Wyandotte instruments, including water drums and rattles. In connection with their pursuit of bringing back the songs of their people, Wyandotte Lifeways researchers and interpreters are learning how to both make and play these sacred instruments as their ancestors once did.
We have guys, they're making their own water drums now, because even back before we had the wood, things that came about in Ohio, people might use a log, or they made them out of clay. They kept finding all these pottery sherds in Ontario, and they had this sawtooth edge on the top edge of these pots, and they said, well, what is it? We don't know what this is. And Richard Zane Smith, he looks at it, he's a potter, and he told these archaeologists, he goes, they're water drums. And the guy said, oh no, that's silly. So he made a water drum just like that. They sound great. The wood ones, especially the small ones like the Haudenosaunee use, they're really pingy. And the rest, they're not. These have a really mellow sound. Those are one of those old, old ways that we've come to understand. It's just like we explain to somebody, okay, we're going to make a water drum. All right, well, you need to go out and you need to dig the clay. And then you got to process the clay, which there's a lot to it. Then you have to go, and if you need to put some kind of binding agent, whether it be shell or whatever, so you have to have that. And then you have to go out, and you got to go hunt a deer. Then you got to take the deer's hide, and then you have to tan it. Then you have to smoke it. Oh, and then to put this on, you're going to need a cord. So you have to go out and find something and make cordage. You got to go find the perfect stick for your drumstick, and then you can have a water drum. So a lot of people are like, wow, that's a lot. It's like, it is. And that's just what it takes to make one water drum. We made horn rattles in Ohio out of cow horn or bison horn, which we all have a whole pile of those each. And we have a citizen that helps us out a lot and made a baby rattle out of horn, out of buffalo horn. Before we had the horn rattles, we made bark rattles. We're in the process of making them right now out of hickory bark. There's a certain time of year you can go in and cut the bark off of a hickory tree, and you cut it and trim it down, and it's almost like leather. And you take it and you cut the shape, you fold it over, and then you tie it up. And as it dries, it shrinks and it closes. The Jesuits wrote about the Wyandottes frequently hitting the bark, which is bark rattles.
Here's Joshua Garcia sharing more information on the Wyandotte's traditional instruments at their public tent demonstration at Fort Recovery.
Hello everyone, my English name is Joshua Garcia. And if I don't have the chance before you guys leave today, I just want to say, Tijime, thank you guys for coming out today. I'm glad that you guys had safe travels here. And if you leave before we have the chance, I just want to say, I want to shake your hands with a happy heart. And wish you guys safe travels back home. So the drums that we traditionally would have, one thing is we would have clay drums. Archaeologists, whenever they were finding these pots, they didn't really know the reason why they would have jagged tooth collars. Up until it was tested out, they were used to hold down the leather whenever we were having our water drum. And then we wrap it with cordage or rope. Some other drums that we have that we're revitalizing are the wooden drum. We use several pegs, about 12 to 15 wooden pegs. This one's a sassafras drum. We'll also on the top taper a tiny, tiny bit. That way the metal collar, which can either be wrapped in leather or cloth, will hold down the leather head. Whether you're having a clay or wooden drum, there's going to be a hole on the side with a wooden peg or a peg from root. One of the pegs that we use sassafras because it expands whenever it gets wet, so it becomes watertight. Some other instruments we have for our cultural revitalization that we're bringing back are horn rattles. The ones that we have on display here today are bison horn and bull or cow horn. So this is what a bison horn would look like. All we do with this is we would thin it down, that way you can get a better sound, and fill it with either rocks, corn kernels, or BB gun pellets. Some other rattles that we would have are bark rattles. So this one's made from hickory. We harvest our bark in late spring, early summer. And with hickory, it's great because you can harvest it and we'll debark it. That way the bugs won't get into it and eat away at it. But also we can store it away and rehydrate it at a later time versus other barks. They don't work as well at rehydrating.
As a deeply resonant and powerful expression of their tribal heritage and culture, the Wyandot's songs are also closely connected to another vital and ancient musical tradition of their people, the social dance, which they have also been working to revitalize in recent years.
The first time we had a social dance was a couple years ago for our winter gathering. It was pretty rough, but to hear the people laughing, see them dancing, it was great. It brought back the old ways.
Here's Joshua and Chris, along with Kim Garcia, speaking about Wyandot dance traditions at their public tent demonstration at Fort Recovery.
In our community, we have a bunch of stomp dances, whether it be for benefit or one thing that's common in our area is to, whenever we host powwows, which is usually Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it's very common, just even if it doesn't have on the flyer, you'll just know that there's going to be a stomp dance that Saturday evening, starting at midnight, unfortunately, after the powwow. Whenever we have a stomp, you'll have a leader or a caller with a fire in the center where they're going to be dancing counterclockwise. And within stomp, it's man, woman, man, woman, man, woman. And then all the women are wearing shells or shakers, cans on their legs, on their calves. So you have to be pretty fit to do that.
You go to Oklahoma and everybody thinks stomp dance. Because a lot of times everybody will get up and they'll say, oh, we're going to have a social dance. Well, you may get a social song or two and then it's a stomp. It's not wrong. Our neighbors, the Shawnee, they brought that, you know, when they were down south and came to Ohio. So we even had stomp dance up here in Ohio. But when you go back in time, the social dances, that is traditional. That's longhouse music. That's what we do when you go back pre-stomp dance.
So one thing we're trying to revitalize is social dances. They can be similar, but also different. And they are different in terms of whether we have singers in the middle or a fire in the middle or your fireplace, whatever longhouse or community you might be visiting at that time, you'll have a central point that you're dancing. Within our community, we kind of sit offset because we're not trying to compete. We want to respect whatever community we're going to. So it's just kind of hard to sit around the fire while also singing because we don't want to get burned and smoke inhalation. So we'll line up all the singers. We'll have one leader or singer with these drums, while the rest of the men will have rattles. One thing we have historically is we shared a longhouse known as the Council House back in Oklahoma. So we're blessed that we have a longhouse that's been thriving for years past, and we're able to already have a staple in our area that we have a place to bring back those social dances.
I'm Kim Garcia, I'm their boss. So I wanted to explain a little bit about the three different styles of dance of what they've been talking about. our traditional meaning our old ways, our longhouse songs. So that's what we would sing in our longhouse. We were from Canada originally. We lived in longhouses. Canada, it gets really cold, lots of snow. We would stay inside the longhouse in the wintertime. So we would do different dances inside the longhouse. We would stay there, we would dance there. A lot of those dances, they're all different. There's different steps, there's different ways of dancing these steps. We would know what the song is and we know how to dance that song. So whatever we dance today, that doesn't mean all of the dances look the same. They're all different. Whenever we came down to Ohio, we were still doing our longhouse songs, but then the Shawnee came and they introduced stomp dance to us. Stomp dance looks, some of the songs are similar that it sounds the same and looks the same, but if you are used to stomp dance, it looks very similar. Most of their stomp dances are the same. That is man, woman, going in a circle. And they just go around the fire, keep dancing counterclockwise. And so in Ohio, we adapted that as well. And so we started stomp dancing. And then we got down into Oklahoma. If you know that powwows are huge in Oklahoma, if you think of Native dancing, you probably are thinking of powwow. That's where they get dressed into very colorful outfits, regalia. You have fancy dancers. My middle son, he used to be a fancy dancer. Lots of feathers and big, and they like to show off. Josh was a grass dancer, and he has different things in his movement. It looks like grass. So that's another style of dance that we adapted once we got into Oklahoma. So there's three different dances. When you think of Native dances, you're probably thinking of powwow. That's not what we traditionally, our old ways, is not what we do. So there's three very distinct ways of dances, and we do all three, but our revitalization is bringing back the very, very, very traditional ways of the Wyandot people. So y'all want to dance?
Yeah.
All right.
The demonstration then moved out to a grassy clearing, bathed in the afternoon sunlight, and visiting families and individuals of all ages and backgrounds eagerly joined Chris, Kim, and Joshua in Wyandot social dances. It was a marvelous and powerful sight to behold, and evoked an image in my mind of a time 2 centuries earlier when the Wyandot may have held social gatherings on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, to which they had invited their non-Native friends and neighbors from nearby farming communities, and at which social dances very much like this may have been among the day's festivities. Not to mention that it also just looked like a tremendous amount of fun. Later that afternoon, at the Wyandot Nation's tent on the Fort Recovery grounds, Chris, Kim, and Joshua shared numerous other cultural and historical artifacts from the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma's Cultural Center and Museum with visitors, explaining how they used them to interpret, teach, and revitalize Wyandot tribal heritage.
That's what the Cultural Center here is all about, is bringing these things back, getting these things back to the people, get them back in their hands. Just making things, our headdresses we make, and moccasins, and so much.
Headdresses and moccasins were among the items of traditional Wyandot clothing on display at the tribe's tent at Fort Recovery. While they are common to many Native American nations, Chris Houck explained to visitors the unique features that characterize headdresses and moccasins as distinctly Wyandot.
This is an Uxquaytra. A lot of the Haudenosaunee or Iroquoian people, they would call it a gestoa. But this is our headdress for ceremony. It has ash slats in it to stiffen it. The covering in here, you can see through it, this is actually a cotton handkerchief. We made that as Oklahoma friendly because green corn, our ceremony takes place in August and it's really hot. So you want something that ventilates. These are wild turkey feathers. Sometimes we will put eagle feathers on for ceremony. The wampum, I just made a small band, so we just put that on there just as a decoration. Sometimes we'll use a really nice ribbon that has a floral print on it, because floral with the natives, it's not feminine, it's a sign of life. So We found a place out of Europe that makes that ribbon. It's really, really nice. So a lot of our guys choose to do that. Our moccasins, traditionally, are pucker toe. All these are commercial tanned leather right now. We will start doing more with the brain tanned. It's very labor intensive. It takes time and some skill to do it, but it turns out very nice. A piece of brain tan, a very narrow string of this, you can't pull it apart. I don't care how big you are. One of our neighbors, the Cherokee, he passed a string around in a class he was doing, and he said, if anybody can break this, I'll make you a pair of moccasins. They had some big boys in there, and they could not pull it apart. It's that tough. So that's why so much of our moccasins and clothing were made out of that, because it's super tough. When it comes out, when you first make it, it's pure white, like snow white. But you have to smoke it, because what happens is if you leave it white and it gets wet, it'll turn back to rawhide. It'll get really stiff. And there's different ways to do it. Some people will make a tent and build a small wood fire out of what we call punk wood or rotten wood. You see a tree that's been down a long time has those chunks. When there's certain colors we look for, like a reddish color, and we'll let it dry really well, and that way it's really a smoky fire. And what happens is the carbon particles from that smoke get up into the fibers, and that way it keeps the fibers separated, so even if they get wet, they don't stick back together. So you don't want a couple of days worth of work to go to waste if you don't smoke it. One of the things that we did after European contact is we started getting these little copper cones, or brass, or later on tin. And they make these cones, and this is deer hair. And we like to use doe tails, because deer hair is really brittle. If you rub your hand on a deer and it'll break, but the tails don't. And does have longer tail hair than bucks. So what we'll do is after a deer's been harvested is we'll take the tail, take the bone out, tack it out, and salt it and let it dry, and then we'll take it and we'll dye it. And then we'll take that tail and we'll cut pieces off, tie it, usually with brain tanned leather because it's so tight and you can make it really small, and you just pull it and then you can attach them on there. So it can be done a lot of different ways. A lot of times on our moccasins, you'll see them and they're cut off, whereas some tribes like to leave it long. It's really whoever makes it. But everybody learned to make moccasins from their mother, their grandmother, their aunts, or other people within their clan. They taught them how to do this. So you will never see a two pair of moccasins that are identical unless they're from the same family. The ones we had in early Ohio times, they had a string that ran through that pucker, and you could tighten it up around your toes. And then later on, we quit doing that. But yet, to remember that, they would go and put like a couple of cones on a string right here, just to remember that old style. So if you see those, they have a couple of tin cones on the sides here, usually with some quill work or bead work that goes up to it, you'll know that is Wyandotte during our Ohio times.
Quill work and bead work are an art form for which the Wyandotte are well known, as demonstrated by some of the masterfully intricate designs on moccasins, pouches, bracelets, and other ornaments that were on display. Kim Garcia and Joshua Garcia explained the techniques used in Wyandotte quillwork and beadwork, and how those methods changed after the Wyandotte encountered Europeans in North America.
So we do use quills to decorate a lot of things, everything from our moccasins to pouches to clothing.
Porcupine quills are the most natural substance that are close to plastic. So what we'll do is let them soak for about 5 or 10 minutes, warm water. This is one of our techniques, is where we would fold it up and down and it would create designs in there. As well as there's other techniques like zigzag stitch and plating, kind of like braiding the quill.
This is a quill work bracelet that I made, but like you said, there's many different styles of quill work, but this is bending the quills up and down. It's a very tedious work. Like this probably took several hours just to get this amount of quill work done.
Quills were used before beads, pre-contact.
Once we started having a lot more European contact, we started trading for beads. Before we got glass beads from Europe, we would make our own beads out of quahog shell. And we would take the quahog shell, which inside is purple and white. We would drill it and work with it, and it would take one day to make one bead. If you were really good, you could make two beads. So once we had European contact, they helped us. They had different tools and different materials that would work a lot better, like iron and different things that helped us to fabricate that a lot faster. So we got to where we could make 6 beads a day.
Also, this is the bead she's talking about.
Yeah, wampum. Today we use glass beads to represent wampum beads because a strand, small strand, about 8 to 10 inches long of wampum beads like that is about $80 to $100. So because it's so fragile, like you can be working with it and be almost done and it shatter. So you really want to be careful with it, and that's why it's so expensive.
As Kim explained, the Wyandot originally used wampum beads not for ornamental decoration, but as a means to record their people's history and cultural knowledge across the centuries in the form of wampum belts, as demonstrated by the expertly crafted replicas of Wyandot wampum belts on display. It wasn't until some time after European contact that glass wampum beads became a fixture of Wyandot ornamental beadwork, in addition to beads made from a variety of other materials, as shown in some of Kim's original beadwork designs.
So we would take wampum beads, and they would be used for more than just decorations, more than just jewelry. We would actually make wampum belts out of that. So that doesn't mean we would wear it. A wampum belt would be like our story. The Wyandot language was not a written language. It was all oral traditions, what we had. So everything that is significant in our history, there would be beaders that would take the beads that the men would drill and they would create. They would take those and they would make a pattern to signify something that happened in our history. So this one, for example, is a replica belt from a belt that was made in 1610. It was the treaty with the Seneca people to declare peace between us. We were warring at one time, and so this was to say we're sitting at the same fire together and we're making peace. So if you just look at this belt, you just say that looks like a square in the middle of a bunch of white. But it depends on what the pattern maker, what they want it to signify. They tell the people what they want. So there would be people who were designated to learn what the wampum belt signified. So that was a thing that was passed between different people, that they became readers of the wampum belt. So our wampum belts would be stored in trunks. And every so often, they would have history class, and they would just sit around, they would pull out the trunks and pull out the wampum belts. And so they might pull one like this out and say, at one time, we were at war with the Seneca people. They were much stronger than us. They had a lot more people, and they killed a lot of our people, and we were struggling. But at 1610, we came together, and we said, okay, that's enough. We're going to make peace. So they made this belt, and we sat together at one fire, and this is what that represented. They would go from belt to belt to belt and just have history class all throughout. We had trunks that we had carried from Canada to Michigan to Ohio to Kansas down to Oklahoma. Unfortunately, during the Civil War, Union soldiers came to the cabin where our trunks were, pulled those out, and they destroyed all of our wampum belts. So a lot of our oral traditions, a lot of our oral history was lost at that time. I want to say lost, but it was forgotten for a time. So that's part of our jobs today, is to research those stories and bring them back. And so that's why we're doing replicas of belts and different things. We have a history class every month via Zoom, and we call it Reading the Wampum. So it's every month. Anybody can join it. We have several people from Ohio that aren't Wyandot that they join us every month, and they listen. And so we tell our stories, our Wyandot stories, during that time. Wampum was not necessarily decoration, but when we had glass wampum also, then it became more and more prevalent to decorate with it. So we had collars and cuffs and different things that were gorgeous made out of wampum. We then started trading for Czech beads, seed beads, so they were a lot smaller than these wampum beads. So when we got down to Ohio, we were beading somewhat, and then Seneca people joined us in Ohio, and they taught us the style of beadwork that they had started doing. When the Seneca people encountered the European women, they saw all the lace on their beautiful dresses, and so they replicated that style with beads. So they would drape beads on the edge of their jewelry and different things. They call it raised beadwork. They wanted to make a 3D-ish pattern. So the higher the pattern, the better it was, and it was prettier that way. So they would make this beadwork that it looked like rope, and it looked like braids that were sticking up off of the thing. So they did everything from jewelry to wall hangings, and it was shared with all the Iroquois people. And it's really fascinating that beadwork throughout all of Indian country, throughout all the world, all the styles are shared between Mexico and Africa. There's different styles. from peyote stitch to herringbone stitch to so many different stitches, so it's hard to tell now where a certain person is from because all the stitches are shared. But this raised beadwork, it is primarily, almost always, if somebody is doing that raised beadwork, they're an Iroquois people. So it's one of the only styles of beadwork worldwide that has stayed within our own people. So it's pretty cool. So we have taken that style of beadwork and we've made it more contemporary. That's what I love to do. I love to do more things more contemporary. So I've taken it and I love texture. So I do all types of beadwork. I take stones, I take crystals, so many different things, and make it into jewelry. So that's some of my stuff that I have here today.
One artifact on display that was definitely of a more contemporary vintage was an object Kim had made using the Wyandotte traditional art form of tufting.
Another thing that we also do is tufting. We would take moose hair and then we would sew it onto something and it would be domed and it would make a beautiful flower or different things. We'd dye it and do that. So I haven't done it yet with moose hair or anything. I don't know about in Ohio, but in Oklahoma we don't have any moose. So I don't have any moose hair readily available. So I decided this year to try tufting with synthetic hair. So I got some synthetic hair, like the Grinch color, and I made this Grinch. So I sewed on the hair, and so it makes it that furry thing. So it's just something for fun. Not everything has to have super deep meaning. It's just for decoration. If you're around Native people for any length of time, you realize we like to joke around a lot. We like to have fun, and this is just one of those things, though. It's just having fun with some of our traditional ways.
Another aspect of their traditional life ways that the Wyandotte have brought back into their culture for fun and recreation is the game of lacrosse, which was represented at the Wyandotte Nation's tent by some traditional lacrosse sticks, characteristic of those used by Iroquoian peoples. Though, as Chris Houck explained, in Wyandotte history, when it came to lacrosse, it wasn't always fun and games.
Lacrosse, one of our games. The Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Nations, Six Nations, they call it the Creator's game. It was given to them by the Creator for his entertainment. Sometimes wars were resolved with lacrosse games, and there might be hundreds of people on each side, and they would go on for days. And your goals weren't on a field like they are now. They might be in a village 5 miles that way, and then your goal's over here. Usually, lacrosse was only played by men. Women were not allowed because, since it's a resolution of conflict, this was viewed sometimes as a weapon of war. Women, in our tradition, are not supposed to touch a wood lacrosse stick. Now, women's lacrosse is a big deal. I mean, we have several tribal members, citizens, that play lacrosse that are they're ladies, and they're quite good. I would not want to play catch with them. They would hurt me. Original balls were wood. There are some tribes they will get lake sturgeon. Everybody familiar with those? They're great big. And there's a piece of cartilage right in the middle of their head that is almost perfectly round. It bounces like a rubber ball. To get it out, it's kind of a brutal process because you can't cut into the skull to get that out. You have to actually break it. But they pull it out, and I've seen some young men that were actually out here in the middle of the street playing catch, bouncing this thing, and it's a piece of cartilage. But nowadays they're rubber, and they do bounce a little bit. They're pretty heavy. We do have lacrosse camp where our young people, 12 and up, we teach them to play lacrosse. We have a tribal citizen's husband who is a lacrosse coach, and he comes down, and then we're starting to have a 7-on-7 tournament. So last year was our first year. Great success, had a lot of fun, but it really sparks an interest in our young people trying to bring it back.
While lacrosse sticks could be considered as instruments of war in Wyandotte culture, there were other artifacts on display at the Wyandotte Nation's tent that are much more universally recognized as objects of indigenous weaponry. Bows and arrows. Making bows and arrows in the traditional methods used by their ancestors is yet another element of the Wyandotte's tangible cultural heritage that Chris Houck and other Lifeways researchers are reintroducing to their people.
I've made bows and went out and harvested the tree and you'll split it, let it sit for 2 years and then start working on it. I've gone out and I've harvested wild rose shoots and things and hazel and made arrows out of them, thin them down and fletched them with turkey feathers.
As Chris explained at the Wyandotte Nation's tent at Fort Recovery, the practice of making arrows using the traditional methods of Wyandotte ancestors is one that can entail some rather intricate craftsmanship.
Napping flint to make arrowheads or points is pretty tough. I mean, there's an art to it. I certainly do not have the art. I've done it, but I need a lot more practice. As some of our flint nappers said, well, you got to make a lot of gravel until you get good at it. A lot of people are familiar with the three fletch arrow. These are wild turkey feathers we fletched them with, and this is a trade point. But then we started doing a little more research, and we discovered some of our ancestors were making these two fletch arrows. And these fly every bit as straight and nice as the three fletch. These are fast to make. With somebody experienced, once you have your feathers trimmed, you can fletch an arrow like this in 15 minutes. Prepping your feathers is the most time-consuming part. You take them, they face the other direction, you wrap them. This is real deer sinew. Whenever it dries, it gets tight, which is really nice. So they're not coming off. And then you just fold them over, tie the other end, that's it. Side by side so you can line it up with your knock. This one, this is wild rose. If you look real close, you'll feel down it. It's not real smooth. This point is very sharp, but you can see where the thorns were and some little stems came off of it. Wild rose, you have to look carefully to find a part of it that isn't really curvy, because you got to take that curve out. And a lot of times, if you've been out hunting, even if you haven't used the arrows, you have to periodically straighten them because the humidity and everything will affect them.
And even for the most seasoned practitioners, preparing a bow for shooting is not an endeavor that comes without its mishaps.
I had a really nice persimmon bow I was putting together, and I was putting a string on it for the first time to take it and shoot it. I was that far from having the string on it, and it exploded into five pieces. I'm glad it blew up then instead of when I was shooting it.
While they were certainly used as deadly weapons of war, bows and arrows were also integral to Wyandotte foodways, having been used as vital tools for hunting. And traditional foodways are yet another aspect of their tribal heritage that the Wyandotte are now enjoying once again in their community. From harvesting the sap of sugar maple trees to make maple syrup.
Until a couple years ago, it had been 179 years since the Wyandotte, as a people, have gathered sap and boiled syrup and all that. We were brought back into it with the Eastern Shawnees, our neighbors to the east and north. They helped us get back into it, which is always a great time.
To the drying of corn to make hominy and what are commonly referred to today as corn nuts, as Chris Houck shared at the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma's tent at Fort Recovery.
The way our people did it is they grew the corn, and most of it would be dried. This is hickory cane corn. It's an old variety. It's a flower corn. It's a dent corn. You'll see little dents in the seeds. What would happen is they would take this and they would either grind it into cornmeal, because it's that little cellulose hull on the outside. You know, you open a can of corn and you'll see those little hulls that are floating around. That's what we want to get rid of, because that's why it keeps us from digesting it. So we would either make hominy or we would grind it. Hominy, the way we make it traditionally, is you take hardwood ashes from oak or hickory, and we sift them down to get all the big pieces out, and we will boil the corn kernels with that. We like to do it in traditional pots over an open fire, and it tastes way better. Out of a can, I can't stand it. So, but that wood ash, and you boil it about 2.5 to 3 hours, and what'll happen is when you first put that in, it makes lye, a really alkali solution, and it starts to pull the sugar out. So this white corn will turn bright orange, like Hunter's Safety orange, and that's the sugars coming out. And then it will start to turn yellow, and then it starts to swell. And as it swells, you start to see those little cellulose hulls start coming off. Well, after about 2.5 to 3 hours, you're starting to see a lot of them when you stir it. So you take it out and you dump it into what is called a rinsing basket, and you rinse it 3 times. And as you rinse it, you work it in your hands, and your hands will just be covered in those little holes. They get all slimy. And then that just means the hominy's done. You can refrigerate it, you can freeze it, or you can dry it. I typically dry mine. And then to use it, you just soak it overnight like beans. And then you cook it up. We make a Three Sisters stew that uses hominy in it. If you take the hominy that's dried and you parch it, just put it in a hot pan and stir it until it kind of turns brown, that's corn nuts. And you can hit it with a little bit of cooking spray and your favorite seasoning, put it in a bag, shake it up. If our youth find out about that, it's gone. It just disappears because they love it. So it's a little harder than corn nuts, but it's good.
Chris also shared examples of the traditional pots that Wyandotte ancestors would use to prepare some of their dietary staples, which he and other Wyandotte Lifeways researchers and interpreters have learned to make by the same methods as the Wyandotte of centuries ago would have used.
These are clay, and this is our traditional style. Because of the way it's rounded, these things heat up that quick. You put them on a fire with water in it, you'll have it boiling in probably 3 or 4 minutes tops. So it's great for making hominy, and it speeds things along. But if you fire them too hot, they get brittle. So it has to be a really slow heating process. And these pots will get just cherry red when you fire them. And you start at noon and you build your fire. And you'll take your pots and you'll set around there, because they have to be bone dry. Your wood has to be dry. Your ground has to be dry. They'll take little clay piles after, when they're ready, just before dusk. And you pull all your fire back and you lay these tiles in there and you put all the pots in there upside down. And you'll lay them down, and then you slowly move that fire closer and closer. And this is all at sundown. And then we'll take big sheets of bark and we'll lay on top of these, and then we'll take coals and put on that. So that way they just fall down. You don't want to shovel them because they're really fragile at that point. I mean, they're fragile anyway when they're green until they've been fired. So this one was just done too hot. I boiled hominy in it, and I went to pick it up off the fire, and it blew out. And I had hominy in my fire and lye water. So there is a very much an art to it.
In a demonstration of the deep interconnectedness of traditional Wyandotte lifeways, inextricably bound as they all were to the natural environment, Chris also shared how corn husks, the protective wrappings covering ears of corn, would be used to make corn husk mats that could be placed outside longhouses to ward off unwanted spirits.
We didn't waste any. These are corn husks. The Oneida taught me how to do this, and they would have big ones of these right in front of the doors of their longhouse, and they would leave them like this, with this side up. That way, anything that followed you from outside that you didn't want in your longhouse, whether it be something that is evil or just a spirit, if it followed you, it would catch in this, and then you could take it outside, put it where it belongs, not in the house. So the corn husk mats, you can dye them. This is the product of probably about 12 hours of work by one person.
The Wyandotte traditionally believed that everything in the natural world had a spirit. The spirit world permeated all things and was a foundational dimension of Wyandotte daily life and culture. While Christianity has also long held a prominent place in Wyandotte society since the early 1700s, Lifeways researchers like Chris Houck and others are ensuring that the Wyandotte's ancient spiritual practices and rituals are not forgotten and will endure for generations to come.
Religion among the Wyandotte since antiquity is not a religion per se. You didn't go to worship at a certain time. It was every day. It was part of culture, part of who you are. Everything had a spirit. Like, we were teasing a friend of ours, he picked some wild strawberries, and it's like, well, did you lay down tobacco? He's like, well, I'm growing some nearby. It's like, that's not the same. Anytime you take, you give. If we hunt, we'll say a prayer, offer tobacco. I go out and I harvest my garden. I lay down tobacco. I harvest sap from the trees for syrup or sugar making. Lay down tobacco. It's just something you do always. It's respect. Tobacco is the most sacred of the medicines. Before I plant my garden, I'll burn some tobacco, praying that it'll be a good harvest. But one of the native things, when they pray, they don't ask for anything. You're just grateful for what you have. And that's a pretty tough chore. I challenged my children to do that. They were fairly active in the church, and I challenged both of them and said, I want you to go a week, 2 weeks, and don't ask for anything. Just be thankful. And they came to me, and they said, Dad, that's hard. I said, it is hard. I said, but that's the way a native prays. You're just thankful for what you have, because they always knew there could be bad years and they would have not.
Much like their traditional spirituality, the Wyandotte's ancient warrior tradition is another aspect of their intangible cultural heritage that has endured into the present day and has moved many tribal citizens to serve and protect both their Wyandotte and American nations.
If you've seen our logo, the more modern one, you'll notice there's a tomahawk and one claw of the big turtle and a peace pipe in the other. We're ready for war or peace at all times. What do you want to do? So that's how we operate. Even to this day, we have fire chiefs that are Wyandotte. My brother is the fire chief of the fire department I retired from. And another good friend of mine, he's the fire chief in Joplin up north of us, a bigger town. There's a lot of Wyandotte veterans and warriors that are still around from modern times. My nephew is a veteran from Afghanistan. He's a Wyandotte. All through the years, the Wyandottes have been big supporters of the United States. We signed a treaty, so we're out there, war or peace.
The story of the Wyandotte Nation is an astounding testament to indigenous survival, resilience, and resurgence against a backdrop of war and conquest, dispossession, removal, and assimilation. As the ascendancy of the United States remade the North American continent from the 18th through the 19th centuries, the Wyandotte, like so many other Eastern indigenous nations, were forced to adapt to a new alien world dominated by Anglo-American cultural, social, and economic institutions that uprooted the environmental landscape and traditional lifeways by which the Wyandotte had made sense of their world for thousands of years, and ultimately forced them from their ancestral homelands in Ohio to make a new life for themselves in lands west of the Mississippi. And yet, throughout it all, the Wyandotte's ancestral tradition of openness to other peoples and civilizations and incorporating outside influences into their own culture would empower them to ultimately endure and successfully adapt to the fast pace of change and monumental transformations on the Western frontier. On their reserves in Ohio, Kansas, and Oklahoma, the Wyandotte would eventually remake their society on their own terms, navigating the institutions and customs of an encroaching modern world while never losing sight of their Wyandotte heritage and identity, and asserting their tribal agency and sovereignty through their deft resistance to and skillful negotiation of the ever-evolving imperatives of United States Indian policy. Today, the Wyandotte persevere as sovereign Indian nations principally based in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Michigan, with thousands more tribal members living throughout the United States and beyond, and with official reservation status for the federally recognized Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma. While restitutions to indigenous peoples enacted by the United States government since the early 20th century can never truly repair the sufferings of tribal nations throughout the history of American nation building, the Wyandotte serve as a powerful reminder of how indigenous peoples have overcome legacies of cultural erasure to reclaim and revitalize their ancient lifeways and usher in an era of renewed tribal identity for their people, while also participating fully in American society as citizens of the United States.
I think they're a model for the future, not just of the U.S., future of the world. We got to figure out, my God, after all these wars, how do we live together? So, an admirable people.
For Mary Stockwell, the Wyandotte story is one that ultimately attests to the enduring capacity of the experiment of American democracy to redeem the sins of the past in pursuit of a more perfect union, and to the importance of telling American history in all its contours of darkness and light, so that we and generations of Americans to come may learn from all peoples who have formed the rich tapestry of the great American experience, and from whom we have inherited the responsibility to carry forward the long struggle toward national healing and reconciliation.
The real struggle, which is our story. Our story should be our struggle. And so many of us historians are trying to get everybody's story in. We're writing the democratic story, the story of all of us, not just our top leaders. We got to tell the story of everybody. It's a big story. To me, it's a story of democracy. This way we have to live together where we all go after our individual dreams, but we somehow can't destroy the life of another. We're just figuring it out. There's got to be a way in any conflict where we can transcend to something better than that. So, and you certainly see that in the American Indian policy, which changed but was trying on all sides to figure out how to live together. Historians can go back and look at these periods, these windows, where we were trying so hard. Maybe we did fail, but we were trying. I think that should be commended. Even if it doesn't work out perfectly, you want all sides to win. It's not possible, but we can do better in the future. I guess the great story is that the experiment that started here in Ohio was fulfilled in Kansas. Many of the tribes, they joined in. We are now one great nation. We have to, I believe, celebrate that. I just tell my students, Crazy Horse and Custer, Tecumseh and Harrison, both of them are your ancestors. And to me, it's a story of America. What a story to be a part of on this planet at this time.
It was the ever-unfolding story of America that was being told on that beautiful June day in 2024 at the old Wyandotte Mission Church grounds in Upper Sandusky, when the descendants of the historical Wyandotte Indians of the Ohio country had returned to the ground where their ancestors had once lived peacefully among American settlers, where their legacy has never been forgotten by local residents, and where they will always have a home for their people.
I wish we had a presence there, but the thing is, even though we don't really have anybody there with the mission church and all that, there's a very much a connection there. But it's a connection more of the heart than physicality. But it's a place that's in our heart. It's in our minds. There is a disconnect at times until you've really been there. I'd never been there until a couple years ago, and I got there, and it was like, this seems like home. I mean, I'm from a small town, Neosho, Missouri, and Upper Sandusky feels as comfortable as Neosho. Upper Sandusky's home. It's hard to explain. It feels right. When you're there, to me, it fills my heart. It makes my heart full. It's a good place to return to. You know where you belong. My great-grandmother used to take my sister and I, when we were just little kids, and we always thought she was ancient. She was in her late 70s, early 80s, and lived into her 90s, but she'd take us by the hand, and she'd pat it, and she'd say, you always remember that you're Big Turtle Clan and you're Wyandotte. Don't ever forget that. Never did.
This marks the conclusion of this Storied Ground series on the history of the Wyandotte in Ohio. Deep thanks to our guest experts throughout this series, Chris Houck from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma and Ohio historian Mary Stockwell. Great thanks also to Mission Church volunteer Nancy Sauer from the John Stewart Methodist Church in Upper Sandusky, and to Kim Garcia and Joshua Garcia from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma. Our voice artists for this episode were Lane Hockwell, Brad Smith, and from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, Chief Billy Friend. I'm your host and producer, Nick Pavlik. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to listen again, go to wgte.org/ground or wherever you stream your podcasts. So long. Or perhaps I should say, Eskoye.
Eskoye means I will see you again. I'll see you soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.